Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and is supported by Talisker Single Malt Whiskey. My guests today are the Mad Explorers, two former Royal Marine Commandos who are currently in the midst of a record-breaking challenge to cross the Earth's five largest islands unsupported. As we'll find out, this is no easy task. As usual, we'll also be answering some questions that you've asked me on Instagram, and I'm going to be sending a bottle of my favourite Talisker to the top question I pick out. In addition, malts.com are offering a 10% off promo code, which is Talisker15DE. That's all in uppercase. Redeemable at checkout on www.malts.com until the 1st of October 2020. Discount may only be used once for individual Talisker Distillers Edition products for sale at £100 or less. No minimum spend, but a delivery charge may apply. Not to be used in conjunction with any other offer, and gift card purchases are excluded. 18 plus and subject to malts.com terms of sale. Here we go, and I hope you enjoy it. Right, here they are, the Mad Explorers. This has been a long time coming. They are basically a duo known as Louie and Ant, although Ant is also known as Chicken for some reason. But Ant has actually been pestering me for a long time, and I've actually been wanting to get them both on for a long time. But, it, you know, time doesn't work out. Ant spends most of his time underwater. Louie spends most of his time under a ginger beard. And so here we are. We're eventually round to it. The Mad Explorers are here. Mate. And I'll start with you first. Can you tell me what the Mad Explorers is all about?
Yeah, no problem. So Louis and myself, we both served in the Corps together, like yourself. And the then...
Corps, just quickly, the Corps being the Royal Marines. There we go.
Yeah, we both served in the Marines together. And we came back from Afghanistan in 2011, and we both got drafted to Commando Logistic Regiment, and we were both fairly dreaders, as we call it, like, which was sickened by our situation. And I decided to put my notice in. Louis was doing his own thing, and we decided, like, from our time in the Marines, we didn't want, like, our last adventure, our last real cool thing that we did to be like Afghanistan and have that define us. So we met up a few years after I'd left the Corps, and Louis was in the process of leaving, and we got our heads together and decided we'd keep the adventure going, but do something completely different to what we'd done. So we dreamt up this idea to be the first humans to cross the planet, to cross the five largest islands on the planet unsupported, only using human power. And those islands are Borneo, New Guinea, Madagascar, Baffin Island, and Greenland. So they encompass like a wide range of different environments. They're all probably some of the last wildernesses, true wildernesses left on the planet. So in terms of a USP, like that was our USP for the expeditions, and hopefully we thought it would enable us to get a lot of, you know, brands and sponsors on board to come along with the journey, because we were both fairly miserable with our respective situations at the time. And like I said, we didn't want Afghanistan and that time of our lives to define, you know, what we were going to do moving forward with our lives. Like,
awesome. So just quickly for everyone else listening, put your notice in means you're going to leave, or you want to leave.
the Corps is the Royal Marines, and getting drafted means you get sent somewhere else. You basically move out. Louis, how did you come up with that challenge? You know, the five biggest islands, because that is like, it is a big thing. I remember when I first heard about it, I was like, that's mental. You know, one island in itself is mental enough. You know, people crossing Antarctica or going to the North Pole, they're mental as well. But to pick the five biggest islands on the planet, which means they're pretty big.
Yeah.
How did that become a thing?
Yeah, well, in terms of size, like the islands are huge. Like our Greenland, our Borneo crossing was the same distance from London Heathrow to Rome. Like, so they're pretty big islands, you know. But it came about, like Ant said, you know, I'd been medically discharged from the Corps, and I was in psychologically pretty shit place, you know. And in terms of life going forwards, like, I really felt like I needed something that would provide an element of value to myself. I felt like I was actually achieving something new, something exciting for me. The thought of what was on offer, just, you know, in your standard civvy job at the time, just wasn't doing it for me. So I knew, you know, there was a big project on the cards, or I wanted to get away and do something pretty special, or at least felt special to me anyway. So I sort of did the normal thing you do when you're having those shit days, and just sort of got on the blower to my mate, and we had a chat through. Firstly, do you want to just do something, mate? And he was like, yeah, mate, fucking what are you thinking? And we'd both been to Borneo before. I said, mate, what about crossing Borneo, you know, east to west crossing of Borneo? And we were like, you know, that'd be pretty special. It's an incredible place. It's got lots of crazy history with the Dyaks, the headhunters and all of that. And Ant came down to mine. We polished off a few bottles of scotch, and we just fucking went through, you know, how hoofing it'd be to cross Borneo. And in our research, we found that that's the third largest island on the planet. So naturally the mind wonders, what's the second and the first? And that was Greenland and New Guinea. And they're both pretty exciting places. So I just wanted to know what the fourth and fifth was. Like, what's the big five? And it's Madagascar and Baffin Island. Again, like two insane islands. And we just thought, you know, fuck it. Should we have a punt at crossing all of them? And it's important to note that neither of us have ever done anything like this. Like, you know, I spent about 3 days on skis before we crossed Greenland. You know, we've cuffed the whole thing, really. You know, it's been a cuff from the start, to be honest.
So how did you, what I'm going to do, just so people understand, is I want to take people on the journey that you went on, which means we're going to talk about the logistics and getting people involved and all that. But then we're going to go and sort of like do snapshot of each island. Cause I mean, each island is a book in itself. So we've got to box clever with this podcast and make sure that we get what we want in, and not everything else as well, cause it would go on for bloody years. But, once you hatch that plan, I'll go to Ant again, because obviously on Zoom, which means we've got to be careful with talking over each other. But how then did you go about like getting interest so this dream would become a reality?
It's a fairly prudent question, that, because that's probably been one of our biggest challenges, like, from the conception. So, like, in terms of the expedition, like what we'd thought up, it was in effect, you know, like, it was very unique. Like I said, it was our USP, because, you know, we haven't got a lot of money, and we haven't got a lot of contacts in that world. And there's nothing really that unique about us. We were a couple of disgruntled ex-Marines who wanted to do something a bit special with their lives. So the fact that we came up with this unique idea made it a lot easier for us to start getting a lot of interest with what we were doing. And what also helped is whilst Louis was in the process of leaving the Marines, he was going off to the Invictus Games, where he met a lot of people that originally helped us get the ball rolling in terms of financial assistance and just putting us in contact with the right people in order to do this, because, you know, like, you can have all the will in the world to do an expedition like this, and you can be, you know, really fit and be able to do them, but if you haven't got the equipment or the money in the bank, you're never going to get it done. So that was and has been like our main hurdle moving forwards with these expeditions.
How long was it? You know, so you've gone out there, you've gone to raise money, you've tried to get some brands on board, you've obviously got some on board, and they've given you some support. When did you start getting kit in, and you were there thinking, crikey, this is going to become a real thing? You know, we've got kit now, and we've got money that we can spend on flights to get places. How long was that, Louis?
It wasn't long, because we deliberately planned Borneo, because we've both been there. We knew that it's to a penny out there. You can stretch your money a long way in Borneo, right? So we put Borneo as the first one, knowing that it's a relatively cheap exped to get off the ground. So we had like a couple of grand in the pot, and, you know, a few sets of jungle boots, some old kit that we proff from the core, you know, just it was mega cuffed, mate. And the truth is, you know, we'll talk about Borneo in a bit, but like, we didn't have any provision for Kazivac. We didn't have, it was cuffed. It was on a shoestring. We just pretty much had what we got. Probably within a few months of the idea, we were on a plane to Kalimantan, and we were yomping from the East Coast into the wilderness with not a great deal, mate, to be honest. So it was pretty, pretty raw and pretty cuffed.
Okay, that's so basically, again, a little bit of a translation. Proffed means acquired, sometimes not legally, but yeah, that's what proffed means, and grizzit and all those other things are what they sound like. But all right, so it was quick, it was moving. I suppose each island was its own expedition and its own budget, wasn't it, in itself? And with that in mind, let's move on to the first island that you cracked, which is Borneo. I know for a fact that you pretty much did it in your pants and a pair of jungle boots, with carrying a rucksack and a few odds and ends inside. But give us a lowdown. How, in a snapshot, how hard was it? Some stories that went with it. And how good was it to know that you'd finished and you'd crossed Borneo on your feet? Well, on a few different things, but mainly your feet.
Well, to start with, like, so we got out to Borneo, and I think within the first 2 days, like, we realised, like, how stupid we'd been in, like, you know, thinking that it was going to be, well, we didn't think it was going to be a breeze, but we thought, you know, like, we had our marine egos and our marine mentality on our backs, and we kind of thought, you know, we'll just yomp it out and we'll get through it. Within the first day, we realised clearly, this wasn't going to be the case. And I remember we were walking out of this town on the East Coast, and we were walking to another settlement about 30 kilometers away. We had about 35, 40 kilos on our back, walking through equatorial heat, and like we were just broken. Like, and we were like, Jesus, we got 1500 kilometers ahead of us. And that first night, as we walked into this settlement, there was this little old lady called Shinta, who she'd had polio in her youth, so she was walking bow-legged. She just came out of nowhere and came up to us, spoke to us in Bahasa, asked us what we were doing, explained to her, and she ended up taking us both to her house, like, bringing us in her house. She lived in this little shoe shop where she made all the shoes and backpacks and stuff in the back, and she fed us and let us stay there for the night. And that was, like, moving forward, that was like a common theme through the expedition. Like, people were so interested in what we were doing, like, even though we were broken and really hurting a lot of the time, like, you'd get complete strangers just inviting you straight into their houses, and just treating us like a member of the family, even though we couldn't speak, you know, a word of English. But even though they couldn't speak a word of English, well, we can't either. So But moving forward, there was a huge area of uncertainty in the expedition, which was the Mulashwana mountain range, and we dubbed it the death zone. So when planning the route, we realised we could get as far west as this area called the death zone, and then there was a 40-kilometre patch through jungle and mountains where there was no settlements, no logging roads, and then the other side, the settlements would start again. So we knew this area of uncertainty was going to cause us some problems, but we thought if we could get to the last settlement on the east side, we'd be able to find a local that would know the way. And relying on that caused us several problems indeed. Like, I'll pass this over to Louis, if you like, there.
It was dodgy. So we got to the end of this, like, we just assumed that there's a settlement, so the tribal dudes must be crossing this patch of mountain. Must be, but they weren't. And they basically said the upshot was this gnarly tribal dude called Bapa Chagao, who looked like a, you know, Dayak legend with his massive machete, naked, ripped, you know. He was like, I'll take you through the mountains if you want, but it's going to be hard, you know. And we were like, happy days, we'll be fine. And we got up into the mountains, and he literally within the blink of an eye just disappeared, and he was just gone. And so we were sort of up in the mountains on our own. We decided to press on, and Mulushwana mountain range are like 2,500-3,000 meters. Their footprint is around the size of whales, like they're enormous. And we were like, day by day, getting more ball bagged and more ball bagged, running out of scran. And it got down to like one day without scran. And then it was like 2 days with no food. And then it was like morning three, waking up, and we hadn't eaten for 3 days. And we were still like looking, these maps we had that were from, I think, 1970 something they were from. They were the only maps we could get. And it was like, we could die here, you know. So we looked on the map, and there was like this headwater away from our route, like a river. And we thought, if we can get on the river, surely we can just like fashion a raft or something and just like float down to civilization. And we made it to the river, and we were properly on our ass by this point. We managed to cuff a bamboo raft together that was just barely floated with us both on. And we started going down the river. But we hit like these, there was loads of fallen fig. This river was like probably like, you know, big river. There's loads of fallen fig trees and shit. You know what jungle rivers are like. They're dodgy, aren't they? And our bamboo raft, I got smashed into one of these logs and just got fucked off. I just remember seeing him getting like ragdolled over me. And I got sucked down under this log. And I just remember like the pressure in my ears was like, and I was just stuck under the water. And I was like, right, mate, you know, don't flap. Just square yourself away, you know. And I was like, breath was hanging out. I was trying to move. I could just feel this slippery log. And I was like, don't flap, mate. It's going to be all right, you know. And it got down to like curtains time. And I was like, mate, you know, you're going to die. You're going to die under a fucking log in Borneo. And I managed to like, almost like a fit and shook my whole body with everything I had. And I got sucked under this log and fired up out. Luckily, Ant had seen what had happened and was like on this shingle beach down there and managed to catch me and like drag me in and, you know, did a bit of jumping up and down on me and shit. And I was, I sort of came to all dazed. And that was when I think first time I thought, this is fucking gnarly. We could die doing this, you know. And do you want to crack on, mate?
Yeah, so we got to that point, and then we carried on sailing down the river, and eventually we made it to the easternmost settlement in this area of West Kalimantan that was on the river. And when we got down there, was loads of kids and that playing in the rivers. They saw us coming from, you know, the heart of the jungle, and they vanished. And then they reappeared with a load of blokes with parangs, and we were like, oh shit, we've just made it through like the death zone only to get hacked to death by some fucked off Dayaks. Like, but they came over, started chatting to us, and we explained like what we'd just done, and they couldn't believe that we'd just come over those mountains. They were just like, fucking idiots. Like, and then they brought us into their longhouse, and we spent the night just like soaking wet, just like collapsed asleep on each other, like ate a load of food. And then the next morning, the Kapala Desa, which is like the head honcho of the village, took us down to the waterfront, and he sold us like this old water taxi that he bought up from Sintang, which was like the main settlement further down river. So like we parted with him, and we got like a decent vessel that we jumped on board, and then we ended up taking that down the Sungai Malawi, which was a river we were on, and then we joined the Sungai Kapuas, which is the largest island river on the planet. It's massive, and it's a big like logging highway. So you have all these barges just towing like all the looted bounty of the jungles downstream. So we ended up just paddling down this river until we hit the tidal delta. Yeah. And then the tides was just pushing us back way too much. So, and by this point, like the raft was, or the boat was so battered, we ended up just ditching it and then yomping the last of the way in.
That's mental, mate. I've got to say, with all of that going on, what happened to that dude that said he was going to take you over the mountains and then just did one?
I don't know, mate. He's probably still out there just telling all the locals about how he saw off these white guys.
Well, I think good, based on doing it, I think good effort. I'm not surprised he thinned out.
Okay, so that's Borneo. Just when it comes to Borneo, I mean, it's obviously the jungle. I know the jungle, but it just eats away at you, doesn't it? It just like completely, just for people listening, the jungle is one of the most hostile. There's lots of hostile environments, but that place, it eats, you rot from places on your body that you don't want to rot from. And everything in the jungle, plants, animals, a lot, it just tries to sort of have a pop at you. It's always trying to get you, eat you, try and kill you. But did you take any sort of like techie equipment? So you know when you're in those sort of like sticky situations, was there ever an option to like, you know, speak to someone and let them know what was going on?
We had a sat phone. We had a sat phone, but it was pretty limited in terms of coverage and stuff like that. So we just kept it buried in the Bergen, waterproofed. The thing is, though, you know, we had a means of communication, but we didn't have a means of anybody coming to get us. So other than just calling your mum to say, all right, mum, you know, we're having a great time. The reality was, where we were, you know, there was no real contingency plan.
Yeah, it's just crack on. You'll be all right, yeah. Okay, mate, actually, did you capture anything on camera?
Yeah, we got plenty on camera. We got given a camera at the start of it all, a broadcast spec one, and you know, we were like advised just get as much as you can. So we filmed pretty much all the expeditions on camera. So I mean, there's plenty of footage. We don't have a clue what to do with it.
So Borneo finished. What's the next one? Which one did you start to do?
Guinea. So in terms of, we came home and like there was, you know, like we said, a couple of times where we obviously got ourselves in way over our head, and we were very naive in thinking that we could just, you know, cuff it and crack on like the way that we did. So we both agreed, like, once we'd successfully got Borneo in the bag, that we were never ever going to leave anything like that to chance again, especially in the fact that we were going from an island like Borneo where it's very jungly, very mountainy, but the people are incredibly friendly. And we were going from there to Papua New Guinea, which is probably one of the most violent countries on earth. Mm. So we realized we couldn't be carrying on like the way we did in Borneo in Papua New Guinea. And we had to plan a lot more in advance, which we did. We got put in touch with a lot of like local guys on the ground who, you know, when I planned my route, I got in touch with them beforehand, and they in turn ended up putting me with locals on the ground who could guide us safely from village to village. So it was a whole different kettle of fish, like planning that compared to planning Borneo, where we just kind of, you know, thought, oh, we'll just cuff it, which is, you know, I would not do an expedition like that ever again.
So, Louis, can you explain a little bit about Papa in a nutshell? And then can you tell us a couple of stories with any hairy moments with the locals? Because they have been renowned for being a little bit volatile.
Yeah, obviously, just to give you an idea, like Papua New Guinea is like, it's like something out of Jurassic Park. It's like when you see that scene on Jurassic Park with the big massive waterfall coming out the side of a mountain jungle, it's pretty much like that. mountain ranges are up to like 4,500 meters all over the shop. The jungle's mega dense, very unexplored, violent, you know, the intertribal warfare there. Every 20K you go, you hit a new tribe and they're scrapping with the tribe next door. In a lot of cases, butchering each other with machetes, you know, in broad daylight. When we got there, we spoke to the chief of police, who was just, it's quite corrupt there. Spoke to the chief of police there and we said to him, like, mate, what's the sketch of us getting, you know, whacked on the route? And he said, it's pretty tasty. There's fighting all over the shop. And he said, I just have my little machete. And he said, can you chop? I said, what do you mean? He was like, chop, chop, chop. I was like, what, in the jungle? I was like, yeah, yeah, yeah. He was like, if you get attacked in the jungle, you just chop them up, chop them up, chop them up. Don't tell anyone, it's fine. So we had like license to kill from the chief of police after we'd been in the country for like a few hours, you know. So we sort of bounced from settlement to settlement until we were in the rural proper jungle. But the people to be really wary of are like a gang called the Rascals, and they're like these dudes that are like in between tribal dudes and Western dudes. They're like proper tribal guys, but they're like, you know, they know what money is. And there's a big campaign in Papua New Guinea between the Japanese and the Australians during the Second World War. So there's a ton of munitions left in the jungle. So these rascals will go into the jungle, find a couple of old shooters and get them working again, and then go into a village that they want to square away and just massacre a load of people there. So we were walking down this highway one day, and this Land Cruiser went past us with a load of sort of smoke billowing out. And I thought, that looks dodgy. In a place where there's like, there's never really any wagons kicking around. I was like, that looks dodgy, but carried on yomping. And my feet were in a shit state, so I was preoccupied on my feet. And then I like looked back and this thing had swung round, and like these dudes came out. And you know what, like, you know what Pacific Islander dudes look like? They're pretty scary. They're stacked, aren't they, most of them, like Fijians and that. And they all chew betel nuts. They got like red teeth, red eyes, big machetes. And he basically had this gun that he'd made out of a staple gun, a barrel, and it had like a 0.5 round in it. And he just smashed it into my face and started gobbing off. And I was like, great, you know, whether he wants to shoot me or not, this dude's going to blow my head off and probably his arm at the same time. So I was flapping, and there's all these other dudes kicking around, big giant dudes. And Ant sort of took charge of negotiations and sort of managed to talk them round to giving them a bit of dosh to take us safe passage to the next village, just oversee us. They sort of agreed to it, and we sort of ended up yomping along with these like rascal dudes for like 15K down this highway and got to a settlement. I mean, there was many occasions on that expedition where we had shooters or machetes put in our face, you know, where we come across dead people that have been, you know, scrapping with each other and that. We could talk forever about the close encounters that we had there. So, yeah, it was pretty dodgy.
It is mental. Like, I've got this vision of Papua New Guinea being this untouched place, which it obviously is. But obviously, you know, yeah. When you talk about the violence there, it's something if you didn't know about it itself, then you would never suspect it, because you just think it's like this untouched jungle island in the middle of the Pacific. But
it's weird because that is the case. That is the case. Once you get away from the coast, like, it is pristine essence jungle. But there's just these pockets of savagery. Mm.
You did allude on to something there, so I'm going to ask Ant to tell us a little bit about this, because I know you did see it. And then that's like, was there anything interesting that you found in the jungle? Maybe, you know, stuff that you wouldn't expect to see, but then when you see it, you're like, that, wow.
So I don't know if you're talking about in terms of the all the World War II stuff that's out there. So like we planned the route. I like when I was when I was planning for the expedition, I got like a load of old World War II diaries and books that had been wrote by Australian soldiers. And there is a tourism industry in Papua New Guinea kind of geared up to this. There's a track by Port Moresby where a lot of the fighting went on. But away from that, there is all these old fighting areas.
Dakota,
because of the infrastructure of the country, like tourists can't get there. And so a lot of these battlefields and stuff have been taken over by the jungle. So we went along one called Shaggy Ridge, which was where it's a 2,500 meter high ridge line. And it's about 2 meters wide in places. And the Australian commandos had to take that from the Japanese that controlled it. So they were doing fighting up this like mud bank jungle cliff, which probably was some of the fiercest fighting of the war. And they were all, running along this 2.5 meter wide ridgeline, taking the positions from the Japanese. Well, we went along this ridgeline, and like there's still a Japanese heavy machine gun still in place there. Like the barrels there, the tripods there. They've still got all the foxholes everywhere. And we were walking along, finding grenades that were still there, you know, completely rusted, and old rounds and stuff all over the shop. And it's just in the middle of the jungle, in the middle of Papua New Guinea. It was mind-boggling to be walking along there. And we were on our asses walking along there thinking, Jesus, imagine having to fight on this kind of terrain. It would have been horrendous for the guys that were doing it.
That's awesome. It was almost as if they'd have just up sticks and left it there. And then did it feel like you were the first people since just to be like, wow, what the fuck's this all about?
Well, that's what it felt like. And there's plenty of other things. So when we'd moved down from the Shaggy Ridge, we went through another area where they'd had loads of dogfighting between the planes. And like we came across a Japanese Zero. It was just in the middle of a field of kunai grass, which is just like the grass that grows on the plains out there, grows way above head height. And it was just there. Like we were chatting with a local. He's like, oh yeah, there's a plane over here.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And he just took us to this Zero. And then the next day we were in a village chatting with the locals in this village, one of these typical PNG villages where all the houses are made out of bamboo and palm leaves and that. We were talking and they said, oh yeah, we've got a plane out the back here. So they just yomped us a kilometer away, and there was a big bomber that was buried next to a tree, like that obviously just ditched. I think the locals go see if there's anything worth taking, and then they've just left them like.
Wow, that's mental. Mental. How long did Papua take?
Papua New Guinea took us 28 days, and we walked from north to south, and it was just over 800 kilometres that journey.
So it's a bit shorter journey than Borneo. But yeah. More probably with the human factor more dangerous, do you reckon?
Yeah, a lot more dangerous. It's probably the most incredible place I've ever been in my life. Like it is amazing. It is like, you know, like what you said, like a jungle paradise, and it's been untouched relatively so because probably of the fact that, you know, that it can't be exploited that much for tourism because of, you know, how dangerous it is. And logistically, in order to rape the country, like a lot of these logging companies and multinational corporations do, logistically it's a lot more difficult to do than somewhere like Borneo because of the fact that all the resources are on these massive mountains. I mean, it's still going on. There's still a lot of exploitation going on in PNG from the big Chinese and Australian logging and mining companies, but compared to what was going on in Borneo, it's massively untouched.
So That's Papua New Guinea done. What was it? Which one was the next one on your list?
Madagascar we did next.
Go on then. Let's have that one.
So yeah, we spent about a month in Madagascar. Obviously, mega redders there, and
mega hot.
Yeah, hot there. And just before we were going, right, we were all prepped to go, and then I saw something on the news about the worst outbreak of the bubonic plague in Madagascar in like 50 years. This was like 2 weeks before we were supposed to go. So I got on the blower to Anne. I was like, mate, have you seen what's on TV about Madagascar? He was like, yeah, mate, I knew about the plague, but I didn't know how bad it was. And Anne's brother's a doctor. And so he got on the blower to his bro and he said, you know, can you speak to any of your doctor mates that would be able to advise? And they basically all came back and said, yeah, don't go. Unless you have to go, don't go. So I was like, shit, you know, well, should we go or whatever? And I remember one night we'd had a few wets and we were talking about whether we should call it or not. And it's still at this point, like financially, it was all on a shoestring. So we'd committed financially to quite a bit already. And if we canned the expert, we would have lost a few grand.
Yeah.
And I said to Anne, like, should we go or not? Because this plague's killing a lot of people. And Anne just said, I've got zero interest in, he said, I got zero value for my own life, to be honest, mate. So you're going to have to make the call. And I was like, all right, mate. So I was like, all right, let's go. And we ended up going. And, you know, a lot of people don't know, it's the poorest country in Africa, Madagascar. It's properly poor country, redders and poor. And, you know, it didn't take long till we were like out in the sticks. There's a little bit of jungle on the East Coast, but most of it's like arid desert. It didn't take long till we were out in the sticks till we realized like, we're going to have to start man packing like 10 liters of water at minimum each to get through these settlements. Cause loads of settlements didn't have water in, like, or they'd have a muddy, muddy well with like the dregs of water. You can't rock up to these settlements as white rich dudes and start asking for water when the people there are literally, you know, hanging out. And soon it started to play on our mind quite heavy that as we're yomping across this country, like people are in such a shit state and we've put ourselves in this position, you know, and we come into these settlements where people are really struggling and, you know, there would be nothing really to eat other than rice, not a lot of water kicking around. We drank from some real dodgy water sources. I got mega ill one day. But I think, yeah, for me, that in a weird way, the Madagascar expedition was quite hard psychologically, not so much physically. Well, it was hard physically, but it played a lot on my mind about like how we live our life in the Western world compared to these people. And you know, we're putting ourselves in this position when those guys who live there would give anything to be sat in a place that I'm sat in now. So
yeah,
it was a peculiar expedition. It was hard, but the lack of water and seeing the state some of the locals were in was hard work, I think.
And with it, because I always sit, you think, I'm going to sound stupid now, but when you talk about Madagascar, you think of the cartoon film and you always think it's going to be dense jungle, but it obviously isn't, is it?
So like with Madagascar, the geography of the place kind of sees it off a lot. So you do have like the tropical jungle and it's all along the East Coast. So you've got this of maybe like 30 or 40 kilometers that go in. That is all real tropical jungle. And it's all because of the humid air that blows off the Indian Ocean that hits a big plateau that sends it back on itself and it all rains and it's very tropical. But then once you get the other side of the plateau, me and Louis were walking over one of these plateaus. It was called the Plateau de Makira, and like it was stunning. It looked a bit like when we were on top of it, a bit like Dartmoor, just rolling quite arid green hills. And then we were going up and up and up and we're just walking along this arid greenness for days on end, and then like the world just dropped away in front of us and it was just like Afghanistan, like red soil, and as far as the eye could see, like this barren like red soil where these really poor people were living. And like we said, there was an outbreak of the plague when we were there. Like as soon as we got off the plane, we got handed these pamphlets by the WHO that were on the ground, and he was saying about, you know, the plague being prevalent. And we were going through these communities where people were dying of the bubonic plague. And it was so difficult to see, like, a disease that is so easily treated. If you catch it early, you just need a course of doxycycline. So we were taking that anyway for anti-malarials. And when we were going through these villages, we were just making sure we dose up on it a bit more. But we were going through, like, seeing this disease that's so easily treated, and seeing kids and the residents of these villages just dying because they didn't have access or the education to access these drugs. And it was bad for me. I felt like real bad about being on, like, our own little adventure going into, you know, what is a living hell for a lot of the people that were there. So I asked questions of myself and what we were doing when we were on that journey. Like,
it sounds like Madagascar was like Louis said, was tough psychologically, because Borneo is more of an adventure, I suppose. You've been there before. Everyone was, you know, the villagers look after themselves. Papua New Guinea was a little bit more dangerous, but they knew what was going on. And, you know, you were aware of the fact that it was dangerous. And then you get to Madagascar and that's a different kettle of fish. All of a sudden, you just see proper poverty. Is that right? Would it be?
Yeah, that's right. And when I was in Papua New Guinea, I do remember, like, there was one of the locals there was saying, you know, like, sometimes they'll come into money, and when they come into money, they all just drink it. Like, they'll spend that money so fast. Everyone just buy drinks and buy their family stuff and buy presents, because at the end of the day, the jungle, when they're living in the jungle provides everything for them. There's always water there. There's always, like, you know, wood and that to make a house, and there's plentiful food. So the fact that they're really poor out in Papua New Guinea makes no difference for the communities living in the jungles, because it provides them with everything. Once you stray away from the jungle and you're living in these environments where you're solely reliant on the rains coming, and that's, you know, there's no infrastructure to protect you, it gets, you know, a lot more damaging.
Yeah. And so then we move on to Greenland, where obviously there's hardly anyone lives and it's absolutely Baltic. So obviously, you know, there was, I would hazard a guess that there was a bit more planning needed, because you needed to take more kit and you needed to probably, am I right in thinking that you needed to train a little bit more, albeit 3 days?
I suppose, yeah. I mean, it's less cuffable than rocking up in Borneo with a pair of jungle boots and machete. You have to have your shit in one sock to a degree. And like I said at the beginning, we've cuffed all of these expeditions. Like, I'm no polar explorer. Like, you know, it's when we skied across Greenland, that's the first time I've ever really done any proper cross-country skiing. And led on a lot of the prep for Greenland. So he became like the little Jedi of skiing and that. He went out to Norway for a few weeks and did a lot of the admin with a little polar mentor, Norwegian chap that gave us some good advice. But yeah, there was more planning involved, but it's a weird one, Greenland, because although it's a massive challenge and there is challenges, like, you know, Ant will probably spin you a crevasse dit in a minute. You know, there's crevasse fields and shit like that. Once you get on up on the ice cap, you just ski on a bearing. You know, we skied for an hour, we took 10 minutes break, we skied for an hour, took 10 minutes break. We did that for 12, 14 hours a day for 30 days. And as long as you're really strict on your drills in terms of, like, if you need to get out of your rack and uncover the tent, then you just got to get out of your rack and uncover the tent. As long as you don't wrap, it's, in a way, it's simpler than dealing with tribes. Like, in PNG, you have to play the game with the tribes. You've got to smoke what they're smoking and drink what they're drinking after you've been yomping 12 hours. You just want to get your head down and you end up shiters in some weird, you know, tripping in some weird, like, dyak bamboo shelter, dehydrated. At least in Greenland, you knew, if you cover this ground today, we get the tent up, there's a hot wet in there, you know, there's a sleeping bag in there, You can get your head down. Mm. So it's quite like a real regimented, simple way of life up until the crevasse fields, essentially.
So it's basically, it almost forced you into the routine you should have had in all the other places, but you couldn't because people were involved.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And then, so obviously there's a lot of skiing involved. You're pulling sledges or polks, whatever people want to call them, which I should hazard a guess at were weighed quite a bit. Mate, tell us about the crevasses, because Louis's dying for you to tell us that story.
So you've got like two sets of crevasse fields in, like on the route that we were doing through Greenland. You've got like the east coast and the west coast, and we managed to get through the east coast crevasse fields relatively unscathed. There was a point I nearly fell through one, but I managed to lean back on my bum, and it was only because like I was really annoyed with my skis because they were building up loads of snow because they had like a layer of water that was sticking the snow to them. So I took them off, and then as I took them off, I stood and I didn't realize I was sat on a crevasse. So I went straight through, but I managed to lean back and sit back. But the real gnarly time we had was once we'd crossed the ice cap, and we were going down what's called the ice pool, which is on the west coast. It's a massive crevasse field, and it's basically what it says it is. It's huge chunks of ice that are about the size of houses, just all over the place, and it's where the ice cap descends into land. And on the last day before we were hitting this ice pool, like, Louis had gone snowblind in one eye. So like we were heading into this crevasse field with like one of us half blind and the other one of us like having to take the lead on the navigation. And that we were walking through this crevasse field and it was starting to get dark, and we knew like if we pushed on we'd get off the ice cap that night. So we were like, right, we're going to push on into the evening. Probably not our smartest idea, but we were fairly fredders with, you know, ice everywhere. So we were going through this real dodgy bit where there was like a cliff. It was a cliff that went down and onto a ledge and then down into a crevasse. And so I'd led forward, and I turned to Louis. I said, look, this is real dodgy, mate. So just watch your footing. And so I followed down, and the polks were being a nightmare because we didn't have rigid harnesses. We just had them attached by ropes. But when we were going over dodgy patches like that, the polks were just going wherever they wanted. And like Louis just came over this like little ledge, and I just watched, like almost in slow motion, watched his polks like jackknife and then just drag him straight into this crevasse. Luckily, he landed on the ledge, but he still fell a good few meters, like smashed his head, and he's just lying there, his two polks still hanging on him down in the crevasse, and he's lying on this ledge. And like I'm shouting down to him, and there's nothing coming back from him. He woke up and then was like, what am I doing down here? Fucking don't worry about that, mate. So like rigged up some ropes and got him out. And then like once we got him out, he just turned to me and was like, chicken, where's my Bergen? And I was like, what? He was like, where's my Bergen, chicken? I was like, nah, you've not had a Bergen on this whole expedition, mate. Like, you've got all your gears in the polk. He's like, nah, where's my Bergen? I was like, don't worry about it. We're just going to get off the ice and then we'll come back and get your Bergen. Don't worry. So that was, yeah.
How deep do you reckon was the... Like, obviously, Louis fell onto a ledge, but if he'd have got... I mean, he'd have gone, would he?
Oh, that'd have been, yeah. Good night, Vienna.
I don't know if you've ever been snowblind, but I was properly snowblind in one eye, and it was hanging out to the point where it was patched over and it was dark. So I was going through a crevasse field in the dark with one eye, and I couldn't even have a head torch on my head because the pain was so sore. So Ant was like 20 meters ahead of me doing all the navving. And probably won't be doing that in a hurry again, snowblind, because I nearly creamed in bad.
How long did Greenland take?
Was it 31 days?
And you did, and if I remember rightly, because I spoke to you, Ant, about it ages ago, you told me about that place you came across.
Yeah, so I'll let Louis talk to you about it. Like, it's mental.
Oh, Die 2 are you talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there's like there's this old, like, it's called Dai 2. It's a US air base that was put there during the Cold War as part of the early warning system from any Russian missiles. And it's like something out of James Bond. It's like this massive Cold War bunker with a huge golf ball radar dome on the top that was left in the Cold War, I think, 80, I can't remember, in the 80s, it was just...
86,
I think. Yeah, 86, just totally left. And it's just like been frozen in time, you know, everything is just as it was, you know, in there. It's like there's still bedding, there's still people's kit, there's still people's photos of loved ones up, letters. There's like an ops room in there. There's a pool table in there, a bar. Like, it's massive. And it's slowly getting swallowed by the ice. The Greenland's like swallowing this huge building. But it's bizarre. It's like something off a horror film or like James Bond. So that was sort of two thirds into our expedition. We came across that, which was hoofing, because the horizon's just so flat, and to try and navigate on just like gray patches of snow becomes a real ball ache. So when we saw like this tiny, it looked like a speck of sand on the horizon, we knew we could just navigate towards Dai 2. And it was a good bit of morale to get there and have a look around and that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just mental, isn't it? To like go into somewhere, they must have just properly evacuated as well. Just ditched it and left it, because most of the time when you get a chance, you just pack up everything you've got, all your belongings, and then leave it empty. But
yeah, I think because of the cost of like maintaining it and everything, once the threat had gone from, it was because the main threat was Soviet bombers flying over, and then that threat changed into intercontinental ballistic missiles, which that radar station wouldn't have done anything against. So once that threat had gone, like in terms of the amount it costs to run and maintain, like I think because it would have cost so much to bring everything out because of how remote it was, they just said like, look, get everyone out, leave everything there, and we'll just, you know, write it all off.
We scrammed a bit of peanut butter that was still kicking around there in the store.
It was mega dry.
that means they ate a bit of peanut butter. Scrammed it. You've cracked those four islands. It's called Expedition 5. Oh, by the way, they're doing it for charity, Help for Heroes and the Royal Marines charity. But, you know, Baffin Island is the last island, and I know you've had a few dramas with getting that final piece of the Exped 5 puzzle sort of put into place. But when are you looking at doing that one?
I mean, ideally, in an ideal world, we would have been doing it this year. Financially, we couldn't. In the end, one of our sponsors didn't deliver. And then, so now we're looking at next year. It's probably a good job it didn't happen this year, because we'd have been stranded out in Baffin Island with a load of, you know, Inuits just living in their settlement, and they'd have been getting fredders with us. So ideally, because of the weather, and we need a good amount of sea ice so that the polar bears aren't going to be on the land, because there's only two of us and we can't realistically be cracking a bear sentry. Ideally, we need it to be in around March time next year. So if we manage to get everything in one sock, we're going to aim to head out on this one. And we've left this one to last for a reason, because this is probably going to be one of the most challenging ones we've done. In terms of geography, it's going to be a very similar climate to Greenland, but the terrain is so much more technical. There's mountains all over the shop, there's huge frozen lakes, and there's like, we're planning on ascending an ice cap along a route that's never ever been used. So, you know, it's truly a world first, this one that we're going to be doing. But obviously we need to get everything in order to be able to successfully do it.
Can you explain to the listeners whereabouts Baffin is?
Yeah, so Baffin, if you go to the west coast of Greenland and look straight out towards Canada, it's the first landmass that you'll hit. So it's owned by Canada. It's a Canadian island, but I think there's a population of about 10,000, and it's all small Inuit communities that are dotted around on the coast. So it's a quintessentially a polar island that's like Scotland on steroids.
And toppers with polar bears. I think it's one of the only places on the planet where the polar bear population is increasing at the moment. So it really is proper. That is where polar bears live. Proper job, you know. So
bonus. What sort of protection? You're going to take it, but you obviously don't want to use it.
Last thing you'd want to do is do anything like that. And the reality is, I learned this in Greenland, it's nice to have a shooter on you for the bears. You got like two pairs of mitts on your hands, you're ball bagged, it's cold, goggles on. If a bear wants to maul you, you're not going to get the shooter out in time, you know. If a bear mauls you, then you're going to get...
I think like my main protection for the bear is going to make sure that I can ski faster than Louis.
Louis's the decoy. Mate, that's awesome. I mean, what is it you've liked about all of that, you know, the exploring side of it? What have you... Ignore the charity side of things. Ignore each island individually. What is the best thing so far with the four islands?
From like a personal standpoint, it's given me a hell of a lot of perspective in terms of I'm quite clear on what I need in life to just be a happy dude. You know, I think I've squared a lot of demons. I've had a lot of thinking time. You know, when you're in your own head, like in Greenland, you've got goggles on, a mask on, hood up, and it's just white, pretty much on your own for 12 hours a day for 30 days. There's a lot of time to think about a lot of stuff. And I think from a personal standpoint, I've processed a lot of stuff, and I think I'm getting a real good perspective on life and what's really important for me. It's been a life-changing experience so far.
And it's definitely, without those islands, you wouldn't have got to that place, would you? Because, you know, the normal noise of everyday life probably wouldn't allow it.
Nah, I think without the project, to be honest, with the mindset I was in, I wouldn't like to consider where I would have ended up or what I would have ended up doing, to be honest.
Good effort. You, Ant, what about you? What's been the all-encompassing thing?
It really has like restored my faith in humanity doing this. Like the random acts of kindness that we've been shown throughout this endeavor, you know, like from day one where we met Shinta and she took us into her house, or for example, when we finished the expedition in Papua New Guinea, we were on a thing called where it was a PMV, which is like their version of a bus, but it's just a truck where people go on the back, and it was all filled with betel nut. And like me and Louis had gone on the back of this truck, and we were coming into Port Moresby, the capital, and we stopped because the driver needed to sell his betel nut, and there was like a load of tires on fire in the middle of the highway, and there were loads of rascals kicking about, and all the locals in the back, they were like, you've got to come in, you've got to hide. So we were just hidden by all these locals because they were saying if these rascals had seen us, because we're two white tourist looking blokes, they'd have just robbed us. So like we were just getting complete strangers looking after like us like that. And it's been like the theme recurring, you know, from the very beginning, that people on this planet are fucking amazing. Like, you know, and it's quite easy to lose sight of that, you know, especially living in the West where we're constantly looking for someone to blame or a group of people to blame for, you know, what's wrong with the world. So for me, that probably has been, you know, the main thing that I've took from these expeditions.
That's awesome, mate. Good effort. Lads, after Baffin, when that happens, do you think there'll be another challenge? And if so, what?
We're going to PNG with you, Foxy.
Okay, there we go. That's it. It's out. We're going to do a trip to PNG. I wanted to go. I've always wanted to go. I've got another friend that's been. And so, yeah, let's do that. You can basically babysit me in PNG. mate, that's sort of pretty much coming to the end of the podcast. Time's cracking on. But what I normally do now, what I do and what I will do now, is we get people to fire in a few questions on Instagram for you guys, and then I've got to pick one out. The person that I pick out gets sent a bottle of Talisker. So so this one is from KML underscore Ben. It says, you've obviously spent a lot of time together on adventures. What are each other's best and worst habits as an adventure oppo? Louis, you go first.
All right. I'll start with the worst. Worst thing for me is Anne snores like a fucking bush pig. And my sleep here, I am dreadful at sleeping, even at home. Like, I really struggle to get my head down. And when I'm on my ass and I want to just sleep and just share in a tent with Anne, it's sometimes that can piss me off. His best, I would say, or one thing I sort of admire about Ant, is that his values are, he's not willing to budge on his values for anyone or for anything, regardless of the environment he's in. What is important to Ant is important to him, and he's got a solid set of values, and he just, you know, he sticks by them regardless of what environments he's in. It could be in Mayfair in London, or it could be some shithole in Madagascar. He's the same dude, and I think that's something to be admired in a person.
And
so probably Louis' best and worst characteristics are probably the same for me, which is, like, he is a realist, where I can sometimes get carried away with what we're doing. So that can present itself sometimes as despondency, and I can be like, fucking hell, you miserable cunt, cheer up. But other times, you know, where I can be like, we can crack this, it'll be easy. And like Louis, like, nah, you need to look at what you think that we're going to do here, because it's not going to happen. So he grounds me, which is very good, because I could have probably got us killed a few times if it wasn't for him.
Right, lads, it's been awesome talking to you. It's been awesome to find out about the four islands of the five cracks so far, and I'm like mega looking forward to hearing about the fifth one, Baffin. If people want to follow you, how can they do it?
Yeah, so we're on Instagram as the Mad Explorers, with an underscore between each one. We tried to change our name on Facebook, but I think because we call ourselves the Mad Explorers, it's like derogatory to us. So we're on Facebook as Expedition 5, that's the word 5, and on Twitter as well. But mainly our stuff just goes on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, awesome. Louis, and thanks for joining me. It's been awesome, and I wish you luck on the next one, or as in getting Baffin cracked.
Yeah, nice one, bro. Thanks for having us on.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks very much to Ant and Louis. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisker for supporting this podcast, and thanks to all of you out there for listening. Thanks a lot. See you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.